First of all, my compliments to all of you for engaging with the subject matter very nicely. The questions that were raised yesterday evening, I thought a lot about this morning, and like to do a little summary. We've gone as far as the first verse of the Pramana Khanda, and you had like lots of questions that I think it requires a little definition, redefinition of what we're doing. What's Pramana Khanda? Section of Tattva Sandarbha. So, a little review. We completed the Mangalacharna verses, eight in number, and number eight is followed by verse number nine. And verse number nine, the first of the Pramana Khanda section, looks back at verse eight and says what you see here. It says from this previous verse, text 8, there are these four items that are essential to be present within a Mangalacharna, and it identifies them. And then listen carefully. The next statement is, before we go further in discussing these four, the subject of Bhagavata Sandarbha, Krishna, because if you remember from the invocation verse, let Krishna be glorified. So before we glorify Krishna, before we do that, and then speak more about vacha, vachaka, sambandha, what's that? The relationship between the words of the book interacting with the subject, Krishna. Before we do any of that, because some of the questions were vacha, vachaka, sambandha, before we do any of that, before we enter into bhakti sandarbha, you know, the means of interacting with the sambandha, before we do that, let us step back and say, before we launch and get into that subject matter, let us first consider what is the evidence or pramana, what's that? Valid knowledge about the subject, you know, like evidence. You know, supposing, taking a different context, I'm just sharing with you my thoughts from this morning to help make it very clear what we're not doing and what we are doing. In a discussion, we'll just use for the moment the context of a courtroom. We want to evaluate something in a courtroom. So before we go into the process of evaluating in a courtroom, some rules are set about what is admissible evidence. Before you get in the courtroom and interact with the evidence, what's admissible? What's valid evidence in this courtroom? So remember, who's Jiva Goswami's audience? It's not, you know, Vaishnava sadhakas. Vaishnava sadhakas want to know, you know, how do we interact with this evidence to get realization and, you know, advance in Krishna consciousness, because that's what we want to do. Before, so that's for us, and for his audience, as you recall, there are different people that have different pramanas, different admissible evidences out there in the world, and even more specifically the spiritual marketplace. And two examples were given, and there's like a variety underneath those two examples, and then there's an unlimited variety other than those two examples. Two examples were the Nyaya school and the Buddhist school. And the little bit that I know, the Buddhist school is very diverse. But there are prominent schools amongst Buddhism, and the prominent message of what's admissible evidence. So let's do the Nyaya one first. We heard there's pramana, there's prama, karana, an instrument that helps you get evidence. And then evidence, admissible evidence, is when sense perception matches truth, and including the mind. When you have reason and logic, nyaya, that matches truth. Well, who's the judge for that? Well, at least let's say what's admissible evidence before we judge. The distinction being a little more clear, I hope. And then, you know, then there's another school of people over there that are Buddhist philosophers, and they say, no, no, there isn't even such thing as things. To have sense perception that matches it. There aren't even things. Neither in time nor space are there things. There's only the moment. And truth, you get the idea. Truth is, what was the language? You know, that which induces right action consistently. That's what truth is. Oh, that's a very different sense of pramana, you know, admissible evidence. They've already long ago dismissed the Vedas. Lord Buddha himself dismissed the Vedas. Just dismissed them. Not admissible evidence. Jiva Goswami's audience is such people. So Jiva Goswami wants to establish what Madhvacharya has established, and he's going through a procedure to do that. What's admissible evidence? And that's pramana, valid knowledge, and the means. So the means may be just like the discussion yesterday. Well, somewhere out there's knowledge. Somehow we just intuitively know. Somewhere out there's knowledge. Now, maybe sense perception can get that knowledge. Maybe logic and reason can get that knowledge. And maybe there's shabda. What's shabda? Shabda means sound from a reliable source. So, and then there's human reliable.
battery.
The Sanskrit word purusha. Purusha. Purusha literally means enjoyer, but it's used to mean a person. Like the Bhagavad Gita verse, purushak prakritisto hi bhunkte prakriti janganan. Purusha means the person, the living entity trying to be the enjoyer. Well, you know, that's illusion. But he thinks he's the enjoyer, and at least he's trying to be. So that's that term, purusha. And then there's, means person. And then there's apurusheya. What's apurusheya? It means someone that's not human. You know, a transcendental personality. Like Krishna. Or Narayana. Or those pure devotees of the Lord that are intimately connected, 100% connected, they're also of the same category. An apurusheya source. So the conclusion of this section is, what is that admissible evidence, valid means of knowledge, like, you know, a light that you can rely on? Because supposing you see a light and maybe it's just a reflection, or maybe so many other things. So what's not a reflection or not an imitation or not a, you know, what's the real thing? What's the real source of knowledge specifically about transcendence or specifically about Krishna? Because that's the invocation. Let us glorify Krishna. And he's identified in the Mangalacharana as is mandated by rules governing literature, he's identified the vishaya, the subject of the text that he's composing. So before we speak about the subject, let us, this is review, let us take a look at what's the valid means of getting facts about the subject. So we're not speaking about how to interact with it. Those facts and the means. That comes later. It'll come. It's part of, you know, the comprehensive, systematic and comprehensive presentation of the Sandarbhas. It's going to come in Bhakti Sandarbha. I'm not a scholar of Bhakti Sandarbha. I can't point you to the sections. But I'm just trying to differentiate what we're not doing and what we are doing. I hope that's helpful. So we can entertain some discussions about how to interact with Pramana. But right now, our focus is, what's Pramana? And this section, to conclude, is what's the best amongst the possible selections of Pramana? Okay? We'll take questions at the end. You may want to come back to, you know, all of what I just said. So here's, in Sanskrit, this word prama, dictionary definition of prama is valid knowledge or admissible evidence. And then a means of acquiring that valid knowledge is pramana. So, hearing apurusheya shabda, this is the, you know, the Bhagavat Marg. It's our process. And then you can, we can qualify it further about, well, the source of that knowledge and how do we interact with the source of that knowledge and what's the disposition of heart that needs to be there, the quality of faith that needs to be there, how do we interact, how do we engage ourselves with that Shabda Pramana? That's in Bhakti Sandarbha. This is what is that pramana and, you know, hearing it. There's a qualitative description of how to hear it. And like some of the discussion about the instruments by which we hear, like the ear. And the mind that processes what we hear. They're fallible. So aren't we going to get, the answer is yes. Aren't we going to get a distorted picture of that shabda pramana? Yes. Because our hearing is deficient. The mind is not properly connected to the subject matter. The mind will filter and distort. You know, the instrument of reception is faulty. And then how to work our way through the faultiness of the instrument of perception is going to be discussed in Bhakti Sandarbha. But for now, the soul, although covered, has the innate capacity. The presentation is, the premise is, there is this connection between the individual soul and the subject matter of the Sandarbhas and the subject matter of Srimad Bhagavatam and Krishna, who's Krishna. And so this is the scriptural foundation for the process. But before we enter into the process, what's the valid source of knowledge? So now we'll fast forward it. So their Vaishnava epistemology, that little section said, Jiva Goswami is following the authority of Madhvacharya and accepting these three, all three, that is, sense perception, logic and reason, and shabda. And the first two are meaningful and valid and acceptable, provided they're in harmony with and facilitate, they're subordinate to shabda. Which shabda says, cow dung is pure. Then cow dung is pure. Supreme Court says cow dung is pure. Shabda is the Supreme Court. So then we went through all these other ones and came to the conclusion that Shabda Pramana is best. Amongst the Shabda Pramana, Apurusheya Shabda is best. And then we ended with Jiva Goswami just makes this quantum jump. There's steps in between, but he just jumps and says, the Vedas. In other words, some other persons in this world, they may accept some other literature, the Bible, the Quran, or Sikhs and have their grantha, and they may look at other Shabda Pramanas and say, that's it. Jiva Goswami doesn't cover that territory yet. But we'll see in just a moment. He lightly touches on it without going into the detail. So stay tuned and we'll have some further discussion perhaps on that particular item. So that's a little review of what we discussed yesterday evening. And now we're roaring on to text number 10. The second verse of the Pramana Kanda. So, the little message addresses this question about other texts that people may consider to be Shabda Pramana. And it's highlighted in this item in red at the bottom. Therefore, direct perception and so on. That means Pratyaksha, Anuman, and the other seven. There's 10. So those, direct perception and so on, are unreliable sources of valid knowledge. We want to understand that object which transcends everything and is the shelter of everything, and whose wonderful nature no person can conceive or imagine, you know, beyond the mind. For this purpose, our source of knowledge can only be the Vedas, which are comprised of non-material sound, because their source is not material. Even they may be describing something material, like creation, or karma, or the actions of time, etc. The Vedas alone should be our pramana, because from them have issued all departments of knowledge, mundane and spiritual, among all schools of thought in human society since time immemorial. That's a pretty bold statement. Pretty bold statement. But let's see what Jiva Goswami has to say about that. At the bottom. What's Jiva Goswami doing? He's explaining the process suitable for determining the Vishaya, the Sambandha, and Prayojana. The process of understanding that. And it's essentially descending knowledge, not ascending knowledge. From the infallible source to the fallible receiver of that knowledge. You know, Nyaya doesn't say that. Buddhists don't say that. Vaishnava epistemology says that. Vyasadeva says that. Descending knowledge from the perfect source. Now, others don't accept that standard of pramana, but he's establishing it. So let's see how he does this. He's going through this little activity that says the source of the Vedas is Krishna. Of course, there's other places that say the source of the Vedas is Narayana, and that's fine too. Specifically though, from the Upanishads, Shvetashvatara Upanishad, he cites, the Supreme Lord created Brahma at the beginning of creation and gave him the Vedas. Well, that's nice. Krishna created Brahma and gave him the Vedas. And that conforms with what we hear from Brahma Samhita and also from Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam. Tene Brahma Hridaya Adikavaye Muyanti Yat Surya. So who is that person who gave it to Brahma? It's from the Bhagavatam message, it's Krishna. From Brahma Samhita message, it's Krishna. So based on those references, although it's here in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, it's a pronoun, he, the rendering of a Vaishnava translator of Shvetashvatara, that Shvetashvatara Upanishad verses, it's Krishna. And what's the basis for that? From other scriptural references, that's what who the pronoun refers to. Now, supposing you're from a different sampradaya, Vaishnav sampradaya, than Gaudiya sampradaya. Well, that pronoun, he, may be rendered as something other than Krishna, like maybe Narayana, or maybe, you know, something. The Kumara sampradaya, they received the Vedas from one of the Chaturvyuha members. And so it may refer to him. That's a detail that we'll get into in Krishna Sandarbha. You know, some other seminar. But, you know, At least it's a person. So, now, the next Sandarbha after this one is Bhagavat Sandarbha. So it's rather, whether it's this form of the Lord, that form of the Lord, another form of the Lord, it's Bhagavan. The source of the Vedas is Bhagavan, the Supreme Person. A person with unlimited potency, Bhagavan. So what's the source of the Vedas? Non-human. Infallible source. That's the message of this little part of text number 10. And then used in this text is Sanskrit term anadi siddha. What does adi mean? Adi means beginning. And anadi means without beginning. And siddha means perfect. Perfection that has no beginning. That's the source of the Vedas. Is a person who is anadi siddha. He didn't become. He's anadi siddha. Eternally situated in perfection. The contamination of matter cannot touch that person. Conversely, that person is in control of matter but isn't contaminated by it. That's the source of the Vedas. So the Vedas didn't come into being and such and such time. Gopi Pranadana uses this language. They're co-eternal. Cool. Co-eternal with Krishna. Like the living entity. There isn't a time, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, there isn't a time when the living entity comes into being. Nor will souls ever in the future come into being. Nor will they go out of being. They're eternal. They're co-eternal with Krishna. We say, our language in worldly time sounds like, you know, once upon a time there was Krishna and he was bored and he looked at his watch and he said, gee, I think it's time for living entities. And poof, there's living entities. But Krishna is the source of living entities. Not like that. We know of events in time and there's events that are not within time and Krishna is the source of the living entities eternally. Similarly, the Vedas are eternal. Krishna is the source of the Vedas. He speaks the Vedas to Brahma, or Narayana is the source of the Vedas, Krishna's expansion, as we heard in text number 8, his Vilas expansion. But in any case, Narayana is the source of the Vedas. But it's not once upon a time there was Narayana and he thought, gee, I think there should be some knowledge in eternal existence, and voila, he made knowledge. They don't come into being. They don't go out of being. They're eternal, co-eternal. You get the idea. So, as the source is anadi siddha, the Vedas are anadi siddha. There's no purusheya source. There's no fallible human source prone to four defects, as we heard in verse number 8 and 9. Okay. So now, again, like a lawyer building his case. What should be admissible evidence? Or why should we accept apurusheya shabda? Without the method of shabda, any philosophers, such as the Buddhists and the Nyayas and whoever else, who do not accept the Vedas, they cannot say anything positive about transcendence. Let alone realize it. Because remember, this difference between philosophy and darshan. Philosophy is love of knowledge. And darshan is, there's a purpose for this knowledge. Self-realization. And there's a means to realize the self. There's a prayojana and there's an abhideya. But the Greek sense of philosophy is just knowledge for knowledge's sake. That's all. Just knowledge for knowledge's sake. But the Vedic system, not just Vaishnava, but Vedic system, is there's a purpose. There's a goal of all of this. You know, why should you be interested in knowledge besides love of knowledge? There's a purpose to it. And then there's a means to achieve it. So, without acceptance of the Vedas, he's doing it backwards. It's reverse logic. Which is, without the Vedas, how can that which is beyond the senses and the power of the mind be known? It can't. What to speak of realization of that? Can't. Yeah? That's what he's saying. Now, someone asked this question yesterday, so no. Jiva Goswami, in his Sarva Sambhadini, his commentary, he doesn't tuck it under the rug, he brings it up. Which is, wait a minute, this sounds circular. And there's a Sanskrit term for circular reasoning, and he addresses it. Sva-shraya. Sva-shraya. There's ashraya and svashraya. You know, someone comes into the room and says, I'm king of New Jersey. Well, how do we know that you're king of New Jersey? Because I say I'm king of New Jersey. That's how you know. On my authority, I say I'm king. Well, that's not valid evidence for, in fact, there isn't even a king of New Jersey. There's no such thing. Circular reasoning is that the premise is supported, or the conclusion is supported by the premise. You know, like in Nyaya, there's all those steps. There's the premise and there's the conclusion, but there's steps in between to reach the conclusion or confirm it. So he brings it up. It begs the question, wait a minute. The Vedas say that their sources are Purusheya. Well, how do you know it? Because the Vedas say it. Well, some people reject the Vedas or don't accept the Vedas for that reason. Valid point. Here's how he addresses it. Owing to the absence of any conclusive proof of the Vedas being authored by a mortal person, no, it's okay. You say, where's the evidence? I'll challenge you. Where's the evidence that it's not? Science does it all the time. It's called non-falsifiability. All the time. You know, rah, rah. I've got this, you know. So then if somebody comes along and says, wait a minute, here's some evidence that says it's falsifiable. Oh, my theory is gone. But until somebody comes up with some evidence that says it's wrong, it stands. It's non-falsifiable. I'll give you a little anecdotal example of this. Our Bhaktivedanta Institute devotees in Berkeley, over a period of years, they had developed a relationship with a professor who had, if I'm not wrong, he was a Nobel laureate like, you know, a renowned, whatever you call that, you know, he had gained such and such an award. What do you call that? Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize winning professor. And they had a relationship with this gentleman. His name is Professor Henry Stapp, I think is Stapp. Professor Stapp. So they invited Professor Stapp to take a sabbatical for a month, take a break from his teaching profession, go to Bombay, reside in the ISKCON Juhu temple, the guest house, and spend a month and study Lord Kapiladeva's Sankhya philosophy as it's taught in Srimad Bhagavatam. Just study it. And the purpose of your study is, please, see if it's falsifiable. Is there anything that you know in the empiric world of science today that would say it can't be correct? It's falsifiable because here's some evidence. And this man was, they described, he was more austere than the devotees. He was up at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, he didn't attend Mangalarti, but from his window he would look over the balcony and see the deities and watch Mangalarti. You know, and he was an intense fellow. And he was up till, you know, not a slouch. And very, very intensely he was engaging himself with the subject matter of Kapiladeva's teachings on Sankhya philosophy, which is, you know, Krishna is the source of everything. And here's how it works, the unfolding of the elements of material creation. In the end, he wrote a conclusion. It's not falsifiable. It doesn't say it's correct. Science aren't supposed to say that. He didn't say that. It's just not falsifiable. And then he wrote a little booklet about it. You know, I have a digital copy of the PDF file that, you know, is what he wrote about it. Similarly, Jiva Goswami uses, there's a Sanskrit term for it. Parishesha Nyaya, the logic of, it's not falsifiable. That doesn't prove it's correct. But you're saying, you know, where's the evidence that the Vedas are, the source of the Vedas is a Purusheya? Well, there's others, but here's one. Prove it wrong. I was on a morning walk with Srila Prabhupada when he was in a certain mood, and he was using the logic of the scientists, saying, I have a proposition. The proposition is, there's cool flame on the moon. Prove me wrong. And he looked around. And then he elaborated on his, you know, proposition. There's light that comes from the moon. Some people say it's reflection of the light of the sun. I say it's cool flame. Prove me wrong. He was demonstrating to us what the puffy wuffies do. They do it all the time. Here's my theory, prove me wrong. Based on da 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 da. So Prabhupada was doing the da 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 da. The light of the moon is cool. So although fire is normally hot, there's a particular kind of fire in the moon that's cool. Prove me wrong. You know, he got into it so much, at least I was wondering, this Prabhupada, he's just like teaching us a lesson about this non-falsifiability thing, or does he really believe that there's cool flame on the moon? He didn't clarify it in the course. He just like was in a certain mood that morning and wanted to teach us a lesson. So in addition, if you can recall reading or hearing Srila Prabhupada, there's another evidence, and that is out of those 10, there's sages or even, you know, transcendental authorities that accept the Vedas are authorized, or a Purusheya Shabda. And, you know, the Ramanujacharya and the primary acharyas of the four sampradayas, and even Shankaracharya and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and so forth and so on. They accept. Now, you're a fellow with your arms across your chest saying, I don't accept. Now, I can listen to you or I can listen to them. And they say, it's a Purusheya. And you don't have any evidence that it's not. And I like not only what they say, but I like the fruit of people who follow what they say. And that's one of the arguments, is those who follow the Purusheya Shabda of the Vedas, their lives become elevated. So now I look at your life, and you've got your arms across your chest saying, I don't accept it. Now I look at the quality of your life, and I'm saying, no, thank you. Whatever you accept as authority, the fruit of that non-acceptance of the Vedas, I like the fruit of acceptance of the Vedas. You judge a thing by its fruit. That's another argument. It's not a proof. But consistently over a period of time, brahmanas, not even Vaishnavas, brahmanas that properly and carefully follow the Vedas, they're luminous. They're luminaries. The quality of their life lifts the quality of the whole society. What to speak of themselves and their lives and those immediately connected to them. The fruit tells you something about the tree that bears the fruit. It's not a proof. So, like the discussion yesterday evening, there's a certain amount of faith. You know, the fact of the matter is, those that have their arms across the chest, they have faith too. They have faith in, you know, their mind and the dictates of their mind and the power of their intellect to discern this from that. And that's where their faith goes. So they object to faith in the Vedas. And we say, well, you're using faith also, my dear friend. And the instruments that you're utilizing in determining where your faith will be placed are fallible. And they'll say, well, same for you, Buster. You know, you're using your mind, as the discussion was going on yesterday, you're using your mind and you're using your senses also. So don't fault me. We have the same equipment together. So the atheist and the theist alike, they use pratyaksha, sense perception, and the sense number six, the mind, the power of reason and logic. With reason and logic, note, with reason and logic, Jiva Goswami is accepting that which is beyond reason and logic. We noted it yesterday, saying it again. But it's reasonable to accept the Vedas are a Purusheya in their source. It doesn't prove it, but it's quite reasonable and quite logical. And we like the fruit and great authorities, and there isn't something that falsifies it. So off we go. We're going to accept a Purusheya Shabda because we want to know about that which is beyond the range of the mind and the senses to even have a clue about. That's where we want to go. So now this is the conclusion of text number 10. And this is a little focus on that statement that's there in red. The Vedas alone should be our pramana, because from them, in fact, have been derived all departments of knowledge, mundane and spiritual, among all should be schools of thought in human society since time immemorial. So that little note says we're going to read from the commentary, starting with paragraph 3. So those of you that have your book, if you like, you can pull your book out. And otherwise, you can just listen. Thank you. To text 10, starting with paragraph number 3. It's not too long. This Anuchade, or text number 10, of Tattvasandarbha calls the Vedas the source of all kinds of knowledge, mundane and spiritual, among all schools of human thought since time immemorial. You know, like the Bible and the Quran and other things. Well, that's a pretty bold statement. Let's see what he says. In other words, all knowledge comes from the Vedas, semicolon. The various branches of worldly scholarship and even corrupted and faulty teachings are the derivative reflections of the original Vedic knowledge. Okay, that's a statement. Now, what's the scriptural support for that statement? Krishna, in the 11th canto, chapter 14, Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna outlines this. I'm just going to read the translations, but you can look it up later. It's 11, 14, 3 through 8. This may be helpful for you in your interfaith dialogue or whatever, whatever. Krishna's saying, by the influence of time, that fifth item, time that destroys all things, the transcendental sound of the Vedic knowledge was lost during the annihilation. Therefore, when the subsequent creation took place, I spoke the Vedic knowledge to Brahma. Krishna's first person singular, speaking to, who is he speaking to? Uddhava. I spoke the Vedic knowledge to Brahma. That's like, you know, the next morning, Brahma wakes up. He takes his bath and chants his japa and goes to the Bhagavatam class. Krishna gives him knowledge. Because I myself am the religious principles enunciated in the Vedas. Lord Brahma spoke this Vedic knowledge to his eldest son Manu, and from Manu, the seven great sages, headed by Bhrigu Muni, then accepted the same knowledge. From the four fathers headed by Bhrigu Muni and other sons of Brahma appeared many children and descendants who assumed different forms as demigods, demons, guyakas, as human beings, siddhas and gandharvas, as vidyadharas, charanas, as kindevas, kinaras, nagas, kimpurushas, and so on. Two more verses. All of the many species in the universe, along with their respective leaders, appeared with different natures and desires, you know, modes of nature, doing its thing with the original Veda given to Brahma, generated from the three modes of material nature. Therefore, because of the different characteristics of the living entities within the universe, there are a great many Vedic rituals, mantras, and rewards. Final verse. Thus, due to the great variety of desires and natures among human beings, there are many different philosophies of life, which are handed down through tradition, culture, custom, and disciplic succession. There are other teachers who directly support atheistic viewpoints. End of Krishna's words to Uddhava. Now, this comes from Baladev Vidyabhusan's commentary on this verse. He's explaining that little passage. All philosophies since time immemorial have come from the Vedas, spiritual and mundane. He goes on, Baladev goes on to further expand on Krishna's words, because, you know, he's also referring to Sridhar Swami's commentary on these verses, where tarka, you know, if, in order to be a learned person, kind of like in science, but also in spiritual matters, you have to come up with a new idea. You challenge the previous idea, present a new idea, get a bunch of people to follow, wow, he's got a new idea. And it, I don't like that other idea anyway. So they follow that guy. And he's got a following. He's got, you know, a religion. You get the idea. And then time passes and all kinds of that kind of thing happens. Now, that's Bhagavatam with Baladev Vidyabhusan's commentary. Here's a little description that comes from Bhaktivinod Thakur. And specifically in his Krishna Samhita, Sri Krishna Samhita, he describes the following. This is a direct quote from Krishna Samhita. Authentic scriptures of various cultures reveal aspects of the Absolute Truth, but among these scriptures, Vedic literature distinguishes itself by the scope of its revelation. The Vedas and their supplements offer a great variety of approaches to the Absolute for people in different situations in life and on different levels of spiritual development. The Vedic corpus includes thousands of separate texts, yet when we carefully study the whole, we find it very consistent. That's if you have the big picture, you can see how the parts fit together. If you don't have the big picture, you go rah-rah for this part or rah-rah for that part and bash the other guy that doesn't have the part that you go rah-rah for. Many generations of reputable, discriminating brahmanas have been satisfied to direct their lives according to Vedic authority, whereby they themselves have experienced the practical benefits. By living according to the Vedic standards of self-control in body and mind, one becomes peaceful, clear-headed, and fit to understand the highest purposes of life. In another section, which I haven't quoted here, essentially, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is the same thing that Baladev says, no surprise. He says, originally there's one Veda, and there's no different view than the one Veda. Then some time passes, and over a period of time, groupism starts, where, according to this place, they favor this particular thing, and over there, they favor that particular thing, and then they start finger-pointing at each other saying, you know, you don't have the, you didn't get it right. And then there's, you know, groupism. And then it further degenerates according to the modes of nature and time. Even something good can become, you know, less than good by the influence of the modes of nature and time. Therefore, disciplic succession, where one is very careful to hand the mango to the next person without smashing it. Uh, take the ripened mango from the top of the tree and pass it on to the next person who then receives it, passes it on to the next person. So going back to the statement that was made earlier, fidelity to one's tradition is very important. Not just because, you know, cultured people do that, it's a spiritual principle. Because the modes of nature and time are active. Even right now, modes of nature are active and time is active. So we have to be aware of that situation, that risk, and be very careful to receive properly and transmit properly. Now, fortunately, there's recorded sound vibration now, and there's recorded literature. And we'll, as we go forward in this section of the Tattva Sandarbha, we're going to find, you know, texts get lost, like big time. So, moving on, we're going to move on to text 11, where this is the concluding verse of this little section. So what's the theme of the section again? It's the Vedas are the best source of evidence compared to sense perception and reason. He again stresses between sense perception and reason. Reason is generally valued more. Although reason is also based on sense perception, it's how you process the sense perception and you reach certain conclusions, reasonable conclusions about that which you perceive. You know, like that's a science. You do an experiment and you evaluate the results and you reach a certain conclusion based on your reasoning power. Yes? And so, you know, science means to know. It comes from the Latin word scire, which means to know. So, he again emphasizes in this section scriptural evidence that says reasoning is a fallible source of knowing transcendence. Now, at the bottom, we see, we'll just do that again. He's argued using reason and logic that reason and logic are fallible. Now he's going to put scriptural evidence, shabda pramana, that says it. And he does it in two different ways. And that is, in the two different ways, there are examples, negative examples, that says reason and logic is fallible. And then there's three that say, better that you hear a Purusha Shabda than reason and logic. Okay? That's what this one is. It's the scriptural support for statements that have been made in text 9 and 10. So here's the first two that say boo and tarka, or reason and logic. One of them is from Vedanta Sutra, composed by Vyas. The other is Mahabharata, composed by Vyas. Now going forward in time, we're going to hear something about the qualification of Vyas. He's not just like a historian or, you know, a learned person. We're going to hear, he's the personality of God. At least our particular Vyas is a direct expansion of Krishna. And we're going to hear more about it. You know, in other words, historians of the Quran and historians of the Bible were historians that were fallible people and they made mistakes. Historians are fallible people that make mistakes. So the Old Testament and the New Testament were written by, and the Bible, by historians. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's interaction with Chand Kazi discussing the Quran Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was Nimai Pandit. He knew the Quran. And he pointed out to mistakes in the Quran, which Chankazi said, well, you're right. I'm also a scholar of the Quran. But what can I do? I'm a follower of the Quran. So I just accept it. It's right there in Chaitanya Charitamrita. There's mistakes by fallible people. But Vyasadeva is not a fallible people. A fallible person. We'll get there. That's it. So here's, rather than go through them now, because the next slides go through them one by one. So there's two that say reason and logic are insufficient. Three that say Shabda Praman is the best. So now let's take a look at them. Please let's remember what Jiva Goswami is attempting to do. He's attempting to assert or explore and then establish infallible means of acquiring knowledge. Yes, that's what he wants to do. And especially when the subject that he wants to know about is inconceivable reality. So he's used his reason and logic. Now he's going to use scriptural reference to show that these other sources of knowledge, sense perception and reason, they can't enter into that realm. Why? Are the Vedas okay? Because their source is not human and the compiler is also not human. The human brain or the faculties of our human existence, both deductive and inductive reasoning have at their root perception. A little sharing, anecdotal. When I was in high school, this high school that I went to was part of an international organization. The title was American Field Service, AFS. And what that did was, from our school, somebody went to some international place, and some international place, somebody came to our school and attended the senior year of high school at our school. So my parents, they didn't even ask me, they just did it. They invited somebody to come and, you know, they would be the host family for someone coming from some other country. So that country turned out to be Japan, and the person who stayed in our home during his senior year of high school was a student from Japan. And we developed a nice friendship. And then he graduated high school from our school, and then he went back to Japan and got two PhDs in the University of Tokyo, which is like MIT over here. It's like, you know, it's the best. And his first PhD, I lost track of him, but I found out because when he did his third PhD at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. So his first PhD was in physics, second PhD was in mathematics, and his third PhD at University of Michigan was in microbiology. Combining physics and mathematics. And his third PhD was the cell division of a frog. You know, like 20 years of getting ready to study how one cell divides into two. Using math, physics, and microbiology. And after he got his PhD, I didn't ask him, you know, what was your conclusion. We hadn't seen each other for however many years. And he wanted to come to New York City. I was based in New York City. He wanted to see the Empire State Building. Oh, no, the Statue of Liberty, because he had seen pictures of the Statue of Liberty. So he contacted me and said, can I come and visit? I'd like to see the Statue of Liberty. He said, well, I've never been to see the Statue of Liberty myself, but come on over and we'll go see the Statue of Liberty. So, you know, we're riding in the subway from the temple down to where the Statue of Liberty is. And I asked him, what have you been up to? And, you know, I just finished my third PhD. Oh, really? And what were you studying for your third PhD? I was studying cell division of a frog. How one cell becomes two cells. So I just casually said, what if the reason behind it has to do with the soul entering into a suitable environment and the soul, another soul entering permits the cells to divide into two cells. He gave a very proper answer. He said, science cannot even discuss that. He didn't say it's not possible. I expected him to say that. He said, it's not something that science can even look at because it's not empiric. It's not within the range of the senses, which then you use to analyze with the mind and come up with a theory or a conclusion that says maybe it's the soul. He can't even talk about it. Okay, you're an honest man. Thank you for being an honest man. And I was thinking, I didn't say it, I said either you're wasting your life or I'm wasting mine. And I wasn't being smug about it, just like, you know, there are things that are just beyond the range of the senses and the mind to analyze the perceptions of the senses. It's just beyond. So, besides the fact that we're defective, there's just subject, so you may not even know matter properly. There are things that you just can't even know anything about. So Jiva Goswami is saying, now with scriptural authority, that's the fact. So here's a painting of Vyasadeva at his ashram writing the Vedas. And one of the negative statements he makes against the merit of using logic, deductive or inductive, tarka, is from Vedanta Sutra. Often quoted by Srila Prabhupada in his speaking and his writing, tarka pratishtha. Pratishtha. Pratishtha is a word that appears in Bhagavad Gita. Brahmanohi pratishtha aham. You can look it up later, last verse of chapter 14, Bhagavad Gita. Pratishtha means the basis or support. The basis or support of Brahman is Krishna. Aham. Brahmano hi pratishtha aham. I am the pratishtha of Brahman. Like, you know, sunshine has as its pratishtha the sun. The basis and support. Similarly, Brahmajyoti has its basis in support, Bhagavan. Aham, person. So if you want to know about the person, Bhagavan, you want to know about Krishna, well, tarka isn't going to get you there. Tarka apratishta, it's negative. Reason has no sure basis about anything. About anything. We use it all the time, but it's fallible. Then, in Mahabharata, that's a Mahabharata painting, by the way. So, there's a statement in by Bhishma Dev, great authority, one of the Mahajans, where he says, same, logic cannot explain things that are inconceivable. Same point. that using logic, Jiva Goswami has stated that logic has its limits. Now here's the scriptural statement. Composed by Vyasa, spoken by Bhishma Dev, logic cannot explain that things that are inconceivable. So those are the two negative. Here's another reference where Rupa Goswami writes in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu towards the very early part where he says something that Prabhupada would say over and over, expert logicians may establish their proofs with great endeavor, but these proofs will simply be contradicted by stronger logicians establishing newer conclusions. It's called science. I remember in high school reading about continental drift, because when I was in high school, it was a theory that was being floated. Anybody not know what continental drift is? Okay, so you don't know? Continental drift. It goes like this. Once upon a time, it's a theory. Once upon a time, continents drifted. And then, you know, this continent crashed into that continent and the Himalaya Mountains came. Because they crashed. Something like that. I don't know the detail. So, when I was in high school, it was a joke. Ha, 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 ha. There's some really dumb people that believe in continental drift. Humbug. Then I went to college and didn't hear anything about continental drift. And some years passed and I was reading something and it was fact. It wasn't theory that was ha-ha. It was a fact. And anyone that doesn't accept the fact is really, you know, dumb. Because continental drift is a fact. Wow. That was like an eye-opener for me. How'd that happen? You know, this is how it happened. With scriptural authority, it happened. Etc. Or, and so forth. Now, here's three statements from Shastra favoring or stating that Shabda Pramana is superlative. So here's one right at the very beginning of Vedanta Sutra, the third text of the whole Vedanta Sutra. Shastra Yonidvat, really short, because scripture is the source of knowledge about the absolute truth. That's all it says. It's just a sutra. Now the one that precedes that is Janmad Yasya Yataha, another sutra. The absolute truth is the source of everything. This is the one that follows that. You know, if you want to know about the absolute truth, you have to go to Shastra Yonit Vat. It's the source of knowledge about the absolute truth. Then here's another one. Number two out of the positive statements. This is in the next section of Vedanta Sutra 2.1.27. Shrutes tu shabda mulatvat. Mula. Mula. The Sanskrit word mula means root. So mulatvat, having the quality of rootness. So, because revealed scripture, unlike perception, is based on or rooted in Shabda Praman. What's Shastra? It's based on Shabda. Aparusheya Shabda, more specifically. That's knowledge. Then, the last one that Jiva Goswami cites in text 11, we're almost done, is from, oh, okay, who's that? That's Krishna. Who's that? Uddhava. Who's that? Maitreya. So this is 11th canto, Krishna speaking to Uddhava in the Uddhava Gita section of the Bhagavatam. And this particular verse is that cited is spoken by Uddhava to Krishna. Now, Uddhava is a great authority. We can say a number of things about Uddhava being a great authority, but here's three. He was a disciple of Brihaspati, which is very interesting because Brihaspati is the spiritual master of the demigods. And Uddhava was considered to be his best student, better than the demigods. Another is, he was an intimate associate of Krishna. Hint, if you become an intimate associate of Krishna, you know what Krishna knows because Krishna lets you know, because you're an intimate associate of Krishna. You know, like you have some close friends. I know some of you are very close friends with one another. So when you're close friends with somebody, you come to know all about that somebody. If you're not close friends with that somebody, you really don't know what that somebody's like. When you are close friends, you come to know what they're like. You know what their feelings are and what they understand. And third, Uddhava was so elevated. Krishna consulted Uddhava what to do. And whatever Uddhava said, Krishna would do. That was their relationship. Now, Krishna doesn't need to ask anybody about anything, but he did. And whatever Uddhava said, that's what he would do. Now, he gave knowledge within the heart of Uddhava what to say, but it was their relationship. Very, very intimate. According to Brihat Bhagavatamrita, outside of Vrindavan, the most intimate associate of Krishna, more than Arjuna. Arjuna said in Brihat Bhagavatamrita, Uddhava is the best. Best. And so here's what that's his authority. Here's what he says. Bhagavatam, 11th canto, chapter 20. For the forefathers, demigods, and human race, O Lord, the Vedas are your own perfect eye. They are the best instrument for seeing what cannot ordinarily be perceived, and for ascertaining the goals and means of progressive life. Prabhupada would keep this very simple and say, use the phrase, Shastra Chakshusha. Chakshusha means to see. So you see through the eyes of Scripture. Just like Prabhupada would give this example. Here's corrective lenses, eyeglasses. So, I'm nearsighted. When I look out at you, I know that you're there, but, you know, details are not so clear. It's a bit of a blur. So now, put on my corrective lenses, and now it's much more clear. 20/20. Seeing through the lens of eyeglasses. Now, the lens doesn't distort the object. It allows me to, allows me to see the object properly. Similarly, seeing through the lens of Shastra, then we can see things properly. At least the possibility is there, although, you know, the modes of nature and other subtle things like desires, contaminations of heart, then still, you know, our seeing through Scripture can be distorted because we, like was mentioned, we have our filters. But at least the possibility is there. You know, the pramana opportunity is there. And then comes Bhakti Sandarbha, where we learn how to engage with that pramana. And here's our last slide for this section, announcing what the next section is going to be. This section was the Vedas are the best means of evidence. And this next coming section is going to be the Puranas are even more important for us than the four Vedas. So stay tuned for that. We'll see this after breakfast together. We're at 9 o'clock, and I didn't allow time for questions. Any questions? Yes. Here comes the microphone. What time is breakfast? 9 o'clock? 9:30? 9 o'clock. Okay, we'll go a little bit later. Go ahead.
Guru Maharaj, the idea of non-falsifiability that you mentioned. Non-falsifiability.
Non-falsifiability, okay. I'm sure you've thought about this one a whole bunch.
A lot.
A lot. He's a professor, a former professor.
Many people have argued with me that your process always puts the onus on the person who is seeking to understand.
Correct.
The onus is not on...
It's cheating.
Because if I'm not able to get the results, you will say you're not applying properly.
Yeah. However, there are persons that have integrity, like Jiva Goswami, and he's addressing, you know, a community of people that have their hands across their chest saying, harumph, I don't accept the Vedas. Well, can you point out to me why you don't accept the Vedas? Well, I just don't accept the Vedas. Okay, I got you don't accept the Vedas. Can you tell me why you don't accept the Vedas? None of your business. I don't accept the Vedas. Well, you know, that means I'm accepting another authority, and that's my own faculties. And my own faculties, I would have to surrender that to say accept the Vedas. I don't want to surrender that. There's a lower nature way, like a cheating way of, you know, a puffy-wuffy saying, here's my theory, prove me wrong. And then, lo and behold, after some time, somebody comes along and says, well, you're wrong. Here's some empiric data that says you're wrong. Now, here's my idea. So this, as Prabhupada would say, and this is going on since time immemorial. It's insubstantial. So what you're saying is absolutely correct. The onus is put upon the person that wishes to acquire knowledge, and if you don't have the wherewithal to debunk my theory stands. And I'm parading around like a person that has knowledge until somebody comes along that debunks it. Then I'm, you know... So, it's the material way of life. Now, this is a method. You know, in one sense, you know, where the Bhagavatam ends, where this Pramana Khanda section ends, is the Bhagavatam doesn't need to establish anything. It's self-luminous. So there. I don't accept it. Okay, so you don't accept it. It's self-luminous. Close your eyes and say there's no light. That's okay. No, so the ways of cheating go on. And then there's the ways of knowledge that also goes on. And this is interacting with people that are, you know, using the ways of cheating. And, you know, it's using their very same technique that says, prove it wrong. It's a Tarka rule. It's not falsifiable. Not conclusive. Or you take anything that's truth with a capital T, you know, who can prove the existence of the soul. Or like this discussion with this student that stayed in her home and has his 3 PhDs. I didn't go down the path of saying, it's the soul, prove me wrong. And he didn't go down the path of saying, it's not the soul, prove me wrong. He didn't do that. You know, because he wasn't a cheater. He was an honest man. Anyway.
Ultimately, to me, it appears that it's a matter of mercy only that someone can understand.
Sure. Again, who's his audience? It's vastly learned persons who are extremely well-read in supporting their school of thought. Some are theistic, some are atheistic. Some are somewhere in between. That's his audience. So with that audience, he's engaging in establishing there's a reason why I'm accepting the Vedas as a Purusheya, besides the fact that they say so. The circular reasoning argument. Now, he doesn't need to do that. He can just, you know, be a Vaishnava and say, they are, and I've seen the light. So there's some people that say, well, how do I know that you've seen the light? How do I know that you're the king? Because I said so. Well, anyway, he's just engaging with those people, using their tools. Something over here. Well, you want to say something.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. So modern science is running on physics and...
Physics?
Modern science...
Modern physics?
Yes. Okay. Modern science runs on physics, and modern physics has what I call leaps of faith.
Oh, they sure do.
I'll point out one, for example. You know, classical Newtonian mechanics talks about speed of light being whatever it is in this reference frame, and in the Einstein one, we say it's same in all reference frames.
It does what?
The speed of light being same in all reference frames, that's a leap of faith.
Okay. This is technical.
And the physicists don't appreciate that they have their own leaps of faith. You know, they blame the religion people of having leaps of faith, but they have a leap of faith when they say that speed of light is same in all reference frames. That's a big leap of faith, and there's no logical reason for that. But it turns out to be true.
Okay.
I have two questions.
Faith is operative even in physics. That's theoretical physics, by the way, which is distinct by physics people. There's empiric and then there's theoretical. And the empiric people go, harumph. And the theoretical people go, harumph. You people are small. You got to get big. Right? Right. Okay.
Okay, I have two questions, Maharaj. One of them is, you'd mentioned at one point that reason is considered better than sense perception. But I missed the explanation.
In society, it's valued more.
Oh.
Because it's the input of the senses are then processed. You know, like the scientific method. Experiment, observation.
Okay.
So that's the sense perception part. And then evaluation and some conclusions. Okay? Now, go ahead.
No, that was a
question. Don't. Yeah. We value Shabda, but we use both.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes. And the second question is regarding what we read in the book. This part that says... in other words, all knowledge comes from the Vedas, the various branches of worldly scholarship, and even corrupted and faulty teachings are all derivative reflections.
And they're products of the modes of nature, in short.
Mm-hmm. So the question is, and the question arose because you did mention that these verses can help with the preaching. These three verses that follow Krishna's words. So
yes.
My question arose that when they talk about corrupted and faulty teachings...
When we talk about Vyasadeva? Is that what you said? When we talk about...
Corrupted and faulty teachings.
Okay.
Does that also include, like when we see sectarianism and groupism and people coming, like taking what the original is and making it something else for their own comfort...
Similar. It's a contemporary manifestation of the same thing, yes.
So it means that all of these things that people are practicing are actually...
All the people are practicing what?
All of these different variations that people are practicing today, variations of, you know, different sects and groups that have arisen, they are from the Vedas?
Well...
Are there...
They're you know, the modes of nature and time acting on them. And then it comes out like this, or it comes out like that. That's how we get variety. You know, like a very simple answer that's less involved than what we're doing is, if you were asked, can you explain why there's so many religions in the world today? A short answer is the modes of nature and time. Because the modes of nature act, some people invest their faith in this. Some people invest their faith in that, and that becomes their religion, inspired by the modes of nature and, of course, you know, powered by Krishna from within the heart. That's a simpler version than all of what we just did.
But all of this is ultimately, the part that I'm trying to figure out is, all knowledge comes from the Vedas. So,
yeah.
Although they're based because of the modes.
The method that Jiva Goswami uses, we're going if we get that far, when it comes to 27 and 28, he explains his method. He's using it already. He'll make a statement, and then he'll apply scripture to support the statement. So there's the statement that you just read three times. There's the statement. Is there scripture to support that? He refers to scripture to support that. Now, I, the reader or hearer of Jiva Goswami, I may not fully understand it, which is what you're struggling with. That's okay. The statement still stands. Now, how does my reasoning power connect with what I know has got to be right because I have faith in Jiva Goswami and what Krishna says in the Bhagavatam, but I'm trying to understand how it is so? That's fine. What you're doing is just fine. Keep going. And it may not be so clear right away, but keep going, and by the inquiry and continued hearing process and so forth, Krishna will make it more clear. But even, nonsense, which is what he's saying, where does it come from? Where does everything come from? It comes from Krishna. And from Krishna comes Shabda. And then there's the distortion of Shabda. I mean, I'm thinking of a very simple worldly example. Some children I know, their very favorite word is no. Say anything and the answer is no. So it's similar to, atheists say there's no God, and Prabhupada points out, just see, they're speaking about God. Even the atheists accept God. Their business is to say he doesn't exist.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
Guru Maharaj, I also have two questions. One is that, so say someone were to come and say, I accept the Vedas, but how do I know that the persons delivering the Vedas to me are not corrupted?
What you're asking, Arjuna asks Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, in a couple of different passages. How do I recognize one who's beyond the modes of nature? Chapter 14, Bhagavad Gita. How do I recognize a soul that is realized? So it's there in Bhagavad Gita. There are symptoms by which one can know, and Krishna addresses. So I suggest you read that last section. And then another very important question he asks is, how does one get there? If everyone is influenced by the modes of material nature, but there are some that are not, how do you get there?
And then my second question is just a clarification. So, Apurusheya Shabda, if a pure devotee is speaking about something material, that falls into the category of Apurusheya Shabda?
There's a committee called Hermeneutics and Epistemology Committee. And one of the things that they're discussing is that question. That is, when in Prabhupada's books he sometimes speaks about something that's not from scripture, Now, how are we to regard that? You know, going over generations, because it's there in his texts. Do we separate, you know, this from that, or are they both this? They haven't reached a conclusion yet. Although I know what the predominating voice is. And the predominating voice has something to do with that Vaidusha Pratyaksha message that we spent a little bit of time yesterday evening discussing. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. My question is like taking one worldly example, like in this Indian court system where the different observations when it is presented and then it is analyzed. So
yeah,
this is from observation, then systematically this is analyzed in the second step. But is it like deep down everybody has weakness for the Shabda? Because
is it what?
Deep down everybody, does they have weakness for the Shabda Praman? Because
Potential is there.
Because they say, touch the Bhagavad Gita with relationship to the absolute truth, say whatever you want to say. So is it like they have weakness for the absolute truth or Shabda Praman? Because otherwise we may go to the wrong conclusion.
Well, the potential, yeah, so take the microphone from him. The potential is there. You know, take your example. How many commentaries are there on Bhagavad Gita? We take Bhagavad Gita, it's Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. And, you know, for example, Krishna says, surrender unto me. Commentator, don't surrender to Krishna. He actually means what he doesn't say. He really isn't so good at saying what he means. Here's what he means. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Don't surrender to Krishna. Something else. Cheating. But, you know, commentary on this is what Krishna means. This is what Krishna says. And, you know, when the approach is ascending, guaranteed it's going to be fallible, so we need this descending method, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. We require the... So one who has such... at least the opportunity is there through descending method. You know, now, back to Nisha's question about, how do we know that the person in the Siptic succession is relaying the message without having edited the message? They didn't open up the envelope, delete some stuff, add some stuff, close the envelope and say, here's the message. How do we know that? It doesn't ask the question, have they realized the subject matter, just saying, did they do any editorial? So then, for that, we have Guru Sadhu Shastra. We have our predecessor Acharya's renderings of the message. And is there fidelity between the present deliverer and those messages? Again, it's not just intellectual honesty, it's a matter of spiritual principle. So, in short, again, the potential is there for each one of us to realize the message that Krishna is presenting. Otherwise, there's no purpose to it. There is a purpose to it. Self-realization. Realize Krishna's message. Know ourselves and know Krishna and our relationship with him. Potential is there within each and every one of us. We have to apply ourselves by right means. Okay? The answer to your question is yes. With, you know, some qualification. Yes.
On this point of the different departments of knowledge ultimately derived from the Vedas, I'm wondering whether in interfaith discussions where you are placed with other representatives of other faiths, is there a room for bringing this point about the superiority of the Vedic knowledge over others? I mean, is there a way to express it in a way that is not really hurtful, but at the same time it is more creating awareness?
It depends on many variables. It depends on the group. Depends on, I don't know. Depends on the relationships within the individuals of the group. It depends on the acceptability, the group dynamics, meaning the group dynamics may say, that's just fine. That's your point of view. And I've got my point of view, and that one over there has their point of view, and we can be together and say our point of view. We're not judging one another. Depends on the group dynamics. And, you know, how that's going to be responded to, it may not be hurt, just, oh, that's interesting, that's your point of view. No transformation, just information. So it depends on the group and the individuals within the group and the relationship you have with the group and the individuals in the group. The purpose of interfaith is not conversion. Perhaps influencing and elevating so that they can be in greater fidelity with their descending process, like Prabhupada would do with Christians, for example. Mm-hmm. You're a Christian. You should do what Christ said. He said, don't kill. So stop killing, or you're not a Christian. Etc. You know, in many ways, very sincere devotees of ISKCON have helped people, without examples, become more careful about being in fidelity with their own tradition. You know, I could say, you know, in a general sense, Madhva followers and Sri Vaishnava followers have become better Madhva followers and better Sri Vaishnava followers by associating with ISKCON devotees. Far more conscientious. You know, taking it in the proper way. It's in the same manner. So, that's a possible outcome for... Then you have to become a little bit knowledgeable about their tradition. Or they can just see in you that you're very faithful to your tradition. That can inspire faithfulness to their tradition. Without the us and them thing. Or, you know, them trying to convert you to theirs. Or you're trying to convert them to yours. Be, you know, more faithful to your descending tradition. No, Jamuna Jivana. He's going to take the microphone. Just give it to him, right there. This is our last question. We're at time for breakfast.
I had multiple, but I asked just one. So, one of the points that Jiva Goswami brings up is that the Vedas are not sourced by a mortal being. The
Vedas are what?
Sourced by a mortal being, meaning sourced by Vyasadev specifically.
Well, the source is the Supreme and the compiler is the Supreme, which is different than a historian.
So, what will be the response for someone who reads Bhagavatam with a skeptical view and says, see, Vyasadeva was bewildered and his spiritual master had to correct him about writing the Vedas and he had to write something else.
I got it. So, say, you know, how are we to understand anything? What's our pramana for understanding the answer to that question? And then you go, that's where you go. If you're going to be, you know, go step by step. On the authority of scripture and our acharyas, Guru Sadhu Shastra, here's our understanding of how that happened. It was arranged by the internal potency of the Supreme Lord for his spiritual master. Now, who is his spiritual master? His spiritual master is a jiva, but he's an empowered jiva. He's a Shakti Vesha avatar, And in any case, he's instructing his disciple so that the Bhagavatam can appear. In fact, that's narrated in response to the question, how did the Bhagavatam appear? It was orchestrated so that the Bhagavatam could appear in that way. Similar to Arjuna becoming bewildered, Maharaj Parikshit doing what he did for the Bhagavatam to be spoken. That's our understanding. You know, we don't go back to the non-falsifiability, you prove me wrong. That's not, you know, the position. We go to Shastra. And the pure devotee authorities of Shastra who concur on this point. That we accept that authority. That's how we understand it. You know, the skeptic can say, well, I'm not sure. I don't like that answer, or whatever however they want to respond. But you know, we have the basis of Guru Sadhu Shastra for making our conclusions about something, this or something else. Okay, we'll take a break.